Welcome to episode 2 of Not On Top. My name's Frank Burton, in conversation with David Ivar, celebrating 20 years of Herman Dune. On this episode, we're going to be talking about songwriting, covering subjects including David's attention to detail, his assistance on writing from real life experiences, and the origins of Herman Dune's most popular song. Let's get into it. First of all, I wanted to ask you about the clarity and precision of the language in your songs. It feels like every word that you've chosen to use has been carefully considered, even the words that don't seem particularly important. But for me, it's that attention to detail that makes your songs so good. Like, to use a recent example, Freak Out to the Morning Dew, your recent song, it starts with the line, it's 2:37 a.m., which is one of those details that doesn't seem important, but the fact is you could have chosen to say, it's 2:30 in the morning. That would mean the same thing, but the way that you specified the exact time as 2:37 a.m, it sounds better, and it's a very small detail, but it has more impact because you use that detail. And are these the kind of conversations that you have with yourself when you're writing a song? Do you think, shall I say 2:30 or shall I say 2:37?
2:37 a.m. sounds better to me than 2:30 in the morning, just because you know that it either has to be true or it's going to sound like it's true, which is, one of the main things you're going for, I guess, when you're writing a song or even like, you know, making a movie, or you just want some truth to it. And when it happens to be 2:37 a.m. when you write the song, it always feels great to just write it down as it is. That's something that I've noticed along the way of 20 years of writing songs. Whenever I use like the real thing, like exactly how it was, sometimes it might sound awkward at first a little bit, but usually never regret it, because it's like, I don't know, there's nothing to regret about the truth, whereas I guess anything else is a choice, is another direction that you might regret later. And in this case, you know, not that I necessarily think about it obsessively when I write 2:37 a.m., I like the sound of it, but also, you know, I'm an immigrant here from a country where there's no AM, PM, you know, and we have 24 hours, which is really simple.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Didn't think of that.
It's really simple to measure the time of day in 24 hours because you know when it's the afternoon and it's the morning. You don't have to say AM, PM. Honestly, I've also struggled at first with just like, you know, 12 PM is after 11 AM. And then, you know, 1 AM, or I don't even know. I'm getting confused just talking about it. It's just like these units in America just drive me crazy. I guess only you guys in England have units that are more complicated than in America.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
So to me, it's just funny. It's just funny that everything has to be... Like I swim, I'm a swimmer. I swim in, you know, you swim 25 meters or 50 meter pools, usually when you're a swimmer. And that's what the Olympics are made of. The Olympic pools are 50 meters or sometimes 25 meters. But here in America, it's 25 yards. So it's almost the same thing, not quite, you know. And so everybody trains in a pool in a different unit by virtue of not choosing the same unit than the rest of the world. This takes me to, I have this sort of theory about the English language that I love, and especially here in America, that it's evolving the way the legal system is evolving in English-speaking countries. It's based on jurisprudence and, you know, the example of what has been before. And something has the meaning that it has at a certain moment, that it has, something has the meaning that has been used by most people at a certain time. Whereas I grew up in France from a Swedish Moroccan family, but I grew up in France where everything is written. The law is written. There's no place for oral law or for different meanings of things, or for the units are all, you know, definite, and you can, there's no cups to ounces, to inches, to yards, to, you know, everything is like decimal and very precise in the system where I grew up. And I find that everything here in America, in terms of units and the language is kind of up in the air. You can sort of make it your own. Like, you know, even recipes, you never really understand what's a teaspoon, what's a cup, what's, you know, I know those are definite measures, but everything's sort of poetic in that way. And I don't know. So I guess I went far from the 2:37 a.m. But to me, it sort of means a lot because a.m. is kind of poetic in itself to me. It's kind of a, you know, after years of being here, I'm still lost in the 12 a.m., 12 p.m. and the degrees, the Fahrenheit and the yards and the ounces and the, you know, ounces are written libs, and it's all that stuff that confuses me.
I could be wrong about this, and tell me if I am wrong, but I feel like you don't use very many metaphors, and I like that. There's a lot of kind of just factual information rather than using a kind of figurative language.
Right.
Would I be right in saying that?
Well, if I happen to find a good metaphor, which is to me a metaphor that doesn't need the "it is like something." You just like state something and it evokes something else in someone's mind. You know, when I find this kind of line that is just like I say something, but to a lot of people, it's going to mean something else or it's going to take another. That would be my kind of metaphor. I guess I was influenced by a Raymond Chandler line that says that for writers, everything has to be like something else. And I sort of never want to be the kind of songwriter that is like, this is like this and this looks like this or this kind of things. But I like true details that are maybe not a metaphor, but that sort of open doors to other images because, you know, not everyone knows. Like I put a lot of, I would put like the name of my street, Santa Cruz Street, in a song. No one knows that street. It's just a little street in the little neighborhood of San Pedro in Los Angeles. I like the way it sounds because I see it written every day when I walk home or when I drive home. And I'm going to put it in a song, but it's not that I'm ignorant of the fact that no one knows where it is and what it is and what it means. To me, it's sort of open doors in people's minds to new horizons within a song. I guess you get the meaning, you know, it's a street, but you don't know. And it's like opens a little door to imagination and dreams with the details that are specific to me. Take different meanings for different people, I think. I don't know. And I've always loved that. Like, you know, again, I grew up in France and hearing songs about Missouri or, you know, places that I would never have been to. They were kind of magical words to me. And later when I got to travel and see the places, it was such a, I don't know, such great moments often to meet the the words that you've sort of imagined for so long.
I do like that with songs, actually, when there's a part, there's a song that I like, but there'll be a part in the song that I just don't understand what it is. I don't understand what it means. And I've got into the habit of just deliberately not finding out what that thing is and just kind of listening to that line in the song and just kind of wondering what it is, but just keeping it as a kind of a mystery. So that, like, the temptation would be just to Google it and say, what does this word mean? Or what is it? Where is this place that they're talking about? But I just like to have it as a thing that I don't know and just keep it as that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, I'm a Generation X or Xennial or whatever, and there was no Google. So I would hear like Rush on Ruffian by The Smiths or something. I just loved that title. I had no idea what it was at all until I played Manchester and drove through Rush on, you know. I don't know if that's what you meant by my use of specific words, but I like little details that can be... I've always used names that maybe you wouldn't expect in a song because they don't... maybe specific names have something about them that is not timeless in a way. But because they're in a song, they become timeless. You know, like all those folk songs with names of places that you've never heard of, but just like they become that song. And I like it.
In terms of like using precise details, like we've been saying, I mean, because you're a songwriter, you can't use too many of them, I suppose, because of the short form that you're writing in. It just kind of like, if you use too many, then the song's going to go on for too long. You know what I mean? So, and also kind of telling stories within that space, within the space of a song. So the stories you tell in the song have to be told in a short space of time. It's very interesting for someone like me who writes novels to consider how a songwriter tells stories, because in a book you have all the time in the world to get everything out there that you want to get out there. But how do you go about telling a story in the space of a few lines is what I'm interested in.
Well, first you got to know that I think that for a lot of songwriters, someone who writes a novel is sort of like an idol, a goal or something, because, you know, to especially when you write songs that are just like three verses, or it seems so unattainable to write a whole story and to... I don't know. It's almost magical to me, just the way that someone could write something good for 200 pages. But I never really think in terms of story. And I must say I've never liked songs that felt like they were a story. That is said with a beginning and an end, because I've always thought that a novel you read maybe once, twice, or, you know, if you love Moby Dick, you're going to read it five times. Or if you're a teacher, you're going to read it 10 times. But a song, you listen to it a million times. So if there's a story, you get bored of a plot. You get bored of the guy dies in the end or whatever it is, like, you know, that you could do in a story in a song. I think you would get bored of it. It has to be a cycle. A song is a cycle. I feel like books are more linear, and you like a book that takes you along the way from one point to another. I think that I love it. Although, you know, of course, there must be a lot of exceptions if I go back to the books that I love. But usually, you know, I read a Steinbeck book and I love the way, you know, you're brought on a path with a character from, you know, it's an evolution. I feel like songs have to capture a little bubble, and it has to be a circle, a sphere that you can enter and go out of from all directions. And you can listen to, sometimes you only listen to the lyrics of the chorus. Sometimes you catch the song in the middle. And if it's a story, in my opinion, it's usually a little bit boring. There are some, you know, Bob Dylan is really good at sometimes at making a story, because they are full of images that are cyclical within a story. So you can always, like, you know, circle around and loop around a word or, you know, as you said, a metaphor of some kind. But in my case, when the writing is kind of simple, and I have written songs that had a story, and I noticed that they are the songs that I sing the least, because I sort of, every time it puts me back in the same place, at the same point A and going to the same point B. Whereas some songs of mine that have no story, I can sing them, you know, at any age, at any time of day, at any mental state almost. And I always find a way in and a way out of it.
Just listening to what you're saying, I think like songwriting is just like a different mindset, really, I think, because, you know, I can write a book, but I couldn't write a song. I've tried, I can't do it.
Well, some people can do both.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
But I find that books that are made like songs are boring because they're not really telling a story. And I think that songs that are written like books are boring because they try to tell a story. And I feel like that's kind of a general statement. Of course, you know, someone is talented, it's going to be good no matter what. In terms of if I had to be broad and general about the way I see things, if I see that I'm going towards a story, like sometimes I have a good idea for a story, I might want to, you know, do a little poem or, you know, maybe do a comic book. But when it's a song, it has to me, it has to be a feeling or a way to see. It's kind of a certain look. A song is a certain look on something, a way to see a situation, a way to see a place, a way to see a person, a way to look at the ground you're standing on or something. It's just like a point of view, a song. And I love novels because they're telling stories, and it's a different thing, I guess.
In August, I went out to the country for resting. There was a family of swallows in the barn, they're nesting. I saw the little ones, and their feathers were greasy. I pictured their life, and I thought it was easy. I said, these guys just have to sit there and squeak. And their mother comes back with insects in her beak to feed them. Said man, swallows migrate and it is amazing. They fly from Alaska to Argentina with their little wings. And I said, I had never heard of such a journey. Someone knows better than me. Someone knows better than me.
On this subject, I wanted to ask you about Someone Knows Better Than Me, which is one of my favorite songs of yours, which kind of has got, I guess you it's got kind of elements of storytelling in it, I guess, because you kind of start off telling one story and then you kind of tell another one. And it's kind of bridged together by the chorus that kind of brings a kind of a deeper meaning to all the things that you're saying. And it kind of, so you start off telling one thing and then you go and tell a related story in the second verse. And I really like the way that you're kind of telling a series of stories in a very short space of time, and that the location keeps changing. So one minute you're talking about something that happened in Stockholm, and then you start talking about something that happened in Coney Island. And some people might think you're just kind of rambling on, but for me it kind of works perfectly. And also I feel like the way that the words to the song sound like they don't really fit in there properly. It's like you've kind of forced them all in there. But actually, that's just the way it sounds. The words do fit perfectly. So I thought that was really, really nice, the way that it sounds. And finally, I like the subject of a song, which is you talking about all the things that you don't know about, which is, I think it's just a brilliant subject for a song. I mean, I expect it's a long time since you wrote that, right?
It's been a while, yeah. I think it was 2008, but I can't remember. I recall writing the song. And this kind of songs are, When I succeed, they're my favorite songs when they are sort of centered around that repeating line. When the chorus, there's not really a chorus except for that conclusion line of the verse. When that line is good, usually, basically you could do as many verses as you want with this kind of songs. When you find something that means something to you at this moment in time, you know, like I have a few songs like this, like I don't know, My Home Is Nowhere Without You, or I Wish I Could See You Soon, or Here Someone Knows Better Than Me. Like, you find something that means something to you at a moment, and all the examples come to you, and you know where they're going because you've got that line that you want to say, and that means, that is the meaning of the song. So I could have done, you know, 35 verses with that, of all the examples that were coming to me in relation to that line, you know. And I love these kind of songs because first they're not that hard to write because you know what you're saying. You're not like you know what you're saying. You just have to find in yourself the examples to illustrate what you're saying, and which I find it very exciting because when you find like one of these songs, they write themselves kind of. So it's really exciting to find one of these songs. And with this one, and as you mentioned, the meter is there's no meter, and it's also the kind of songs that you can't really fake it. The no meter lyrics to me, because it sounds fake when you're like pretending to rush words and to, you know, to squeeze them in there. But when you want to say something and the word is long and, you know, you forget about the meter, and it's usually very pleasurable. It's groovy, I think, as a songwriter. There's like grooves that come from words and not from you that are really, I don't know, they're entertaining to me as a singer. And if you like that song, it means it's entertaining, I guess, or it's pleasurable to you as a listener. And I love that. I respect meter. I love writing songs that are more based on meter and, you know, rules and all that stuff. I like it. I have appreciation and respect for the tradition. But when you can go off base and just feel free to write a song because you know what you're saying, it's really a pleasing feeling as a writer. Even if you're like writing about something sad, actually, just like the excitement of the moment where you sort of know what you have to say and you just do it. It's really exciting.
And then we were in Stockholm and it was beautiful in July. And the day after this famous Swedish director Ingmar Bergman died, all the national papers had some special issues with beautiful pictures and interesting interviews. I figured it was unlikely that they would gather all this stuff overnight. They must have needed much more time than this to write. And it felt rancid. And you said, David, David, don't you know about obituaries? They keep them at hand for the death of celebrities. And I said, I will never get used to how twisted news can be. Someone knows better than me. Someone knows better than me.
Was there a particular time when you kind of figured that out? Was there a particular song where you came across this idea that, oh, actually, I don't have to use meter. I can just do it this other way.
I wish I had found out about it, but it's more the other way around. I was sort of ignorant about meter at first. Like, you know, the first album that came out, Turn Off the Light, 20 years ago, I knew traditional folk music and 60s folk, and I loved it, but I had never thought about using the same kind of meter. For me, there was no reason for me to use something that had been done before. I had never thought about it. First time I wrote a song, it was crazy words, not fitting the meter, and I liked it, and it became some sort of, I was proud about it. I remember talking to a friend, Turner Cody, who's a great songwriter and who likes tradition and writes traditional songs. It was not an argument, but we had a discussion about my opinion at the time. So it must have been around 2002 or 3. I was telling him that there's no reason to not use the word that means what you want to say. There's no reason to not use that word. It's just, this must be the perfect word. Sometimes it's not going to rhyme. Sometimes it's not going to fit. But if that's what you want to say, use the word. So I used to be very sort of proud about, not proud, but, you know, attached to my idea that this is how I wanted to write songs. But I also evolved in a way that I can appreciate how the rhythm and the meter and the rhyming of words sort of develop other avenues into your thinking, you know, and how you can totally come to a deep meaning using techniques just because the brain moves in ways that you don't always understand. And sometimes it's you're looking for a word that rhymes and you end up finding the perfect word for your song. It's different, I guess.
Would you say that your feelings about structure have changed over the years in terms of song structures and things like that?
I think because, and it might be the case for a lot of people starting out in an art form, there's some kind of arrogance when you start out about you just want to be yourself and, you know, anything before you is kind of, you don't want to hear it again and you think you're gonna, you want to make your own way. So I guess I started that way, just not being moved by comments or, you know, not trying to fit in any structure that I knew from songs that I loved before. I thought, you know, I don't have to worry about this. And with time, I just, you know, because with time you try different things and I found structures and ways to write that that have a tradition and that interests me and that allow me to express myself in ways that that mean something to me. So I just, you know, with time you try more things and there's more things than just one that works, you know. I started out with like, there's only one way and that's the right way. And now I'm more like, you know, whatever works.
So much prettier when you smile.
Took my baby down a vinegar hill. She planted a kiss on me, and it gave me a thrill. I said, I'll keep you in my pocket like a $2 bill. She said, all right, I'll make you lucky, and I know she will. We passed the halfway house and the Italian store. She was tiny as a mouse and pretty as a shore. I said, I'll keep you in my pocket like a handkerchief. A secret in my heart, a true belief.
That's spooky, monkey.
I mentioned your use of different locations. I think it's a big thing that kind of connects all of your songs together in a way, is the use of different places. And one interesting thing about the Notes from Vinegar Hill album is that pretty much all the songs are set in LA. So listening to that album, you hear all these different references to LA. And sometimes it's just like a little place that you mention in passing. Sometimes it's more, you get kind of more into your relationship with that place, like in LA Blues, for example. So, I mean, how important are these places in your songs generally? Would you say that the place is an important part of the song?
It is. It they have been for all of my songs always. So I don't know if that's a special thing or if a lot of people are like me, but places have, for sonic reasons, but also mindscape reasons, been very important. I'm not really someone who can make up a story. I can make up situations, but I have to see where it takes place. I have to sort of know the characters. You know, I'm not like a science fiction writer or anything. Like I couldn't make up a place. I couldn't make up a planet. So I sort of feed on street names, you know, names of places or bus lines, train lines, you know, plane terminals. Whatever I come across that has a specific name, usually it's really inspiring to me. And streets in Los Angeles have you know, these good street names, good neighborhood names. And I go through them, so they mean something to me. And I guess that meaning infuses through the lyrics, I think. And they're always like, they're fun rhymes to use. I had a song that rhymed Santa Monica and harmonica. And I thought that was funny, you know. It's just funny. This is like, there's a lot of things that I say about songwriting that I've come to learn that they mean a lot to me, but they're not necessarily obvious to the listener. I would just use an example. Recently, I got to see, it was before the pandemic, but I got to see Lucinda Williams perform Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. And she was playing the album and giving some sort of a masterclass about it. And she was explaining the lyrics to each song, which usually I'm not a fan of those sort of, because I think sometimes it can kill the charm a little bit, but she was great. And while she was telling about writing those songs, basically she said that she was making it up. Like she was like taking names from a map, which I have never done, and making up songs about these places that she hadn't even been to. I was so surprised because to me, every song, every verse, every line of her songs had to be true. She sings them like to me, she's a blues singer. You know, she's singing her heart out. I thought they were all about, you know, her breakups and her, I was driving through this town and that town and this happened to me. I was so sure, so convinced that everything was true in that album. And she was there on the microphone basically saying that she made it up. Like one song, like June Bug versus the Hurricane, comes from a photograph she saw in an art book of all. And I mean, it's like, so she had all these examples of stuff she made up from just like names that sounded good to her. And it made me think that I usually, in my songs, everything's kind of related to where I'm sitting when I'm writing the song. You know, I just look up, you know, like Willie Nelson says about it, his first song, Hello Wall, where he was just sitting looking at the wall and he wrote Hello Wall. And I'm more like this kind of writer where I'm just sitting where, okay, I'm at the Sirens Cafe and Sirens Cafe is going to be in the song, you know. Or so I was impressed that she totally made it up. And I guess what I'm saying is that for people, it doesn't make any difference. Like, you know, who knows that I was, you know, I could write a song about, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma tomorrow, and people would think that I have been there, but I wasn't. I would be here in San Pedro.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, if something sounds authentic, you don't question it. It's just, if it has that feeling that it is a real thing, then that's fine. You know, it's kind of, it almost doesn't matter whether it's true or not, I guess.
It matters to me when I write. Like I would feel so bad making up stuff for some reason, but it doesn't matter. And of course, you know, gangster rappers are the first victims of us, you know, thinking that everything that a songwriter writes is true, or, you know, so people always assume that what you say is what you do. But I guess you don't need to if you write good songs. Happened to me too with a songwriter that is a little less famous than Lucinda Williams. He was John Daniel of the Mountain Goats. He was really my introduction to home recording and sort of, at the time they were calling that music lo-fi, and Herman Dune was called lo-fi when we started. And John Daniel of the Mountain Goats, a friend of mine bought me his record Sweden because I was of Swedish citizenship. And for my birthday, I guess it was my 16th or 17th birthday, maybe. And so that album, Sweden, had songs. The titles were like Going to Seoul or all these names of places and all these stories. And to me, John Daniel was someone who traveled all along the world. And I was like thinking about him. And I thought he was this backpacker with all this, you know, with a guitar, writing songs all around the world. And I ended up meeting him, and we were on the same label, Shrimper, for a while. And he totally makes it up. It's just like outright imagination. He most of these songs were written in Claremont or somewhere in California, Upland or wherever it was living at the time. And I was so surprised. And again, it was a proof to me that you can make stuff up, you know, and it doesn't matter for the listener.
I had to leave you and go away, but I think about you every day, in the morning and in the afternoon. I wish that I could see you soon. And when I held you, I felt so fine. It was like there was nothing left on my mind. It was like Rockaway Beach in the month of June. I wish that I could see you soon. I had no plans to meet you, baby. I had a million things to do, baby, but you hit my heart with a harpoon. I wish that I could see you soon. The angels go,
how long till you can see her?
And I'm like, the sooner the better.
Do you really think she will wait for you?
Well, I have nowhere to say, and there's nothing I can do. Well, I have
nowhere to say, and there's nothing I can do.
Go.
I should ask you about I Wish That I Could See You Soon, because it's your most played song in terms of streaming, I believe. So I suspect there'll be people listening who want to hear about that song in particular. So what can you tell me about that one? You know, when you wrote it, did you have a feeling it was going to be as popular as it's proven to be?
Not at all. I didn't know. It's really my most popular song, and it still, you know, was used recently in a show that is like the most popular show on Netflix called Money Heist or Casa de Papel, or it's a Spanish show, so people keep relating to it. And it's been 2006, it's been 15 years. So no, it's one of these songs where I had that line that I thought was on point, you know, it was totally fitting with the feeling that I felt. I was on a plane from Paris to New York, and I wrote that song really fast, just with that line that I thought had something special. No music. I didn't have my guitar with me. I was on a plane. I just wrote it on a little notebook. It sort of constructed itself from scratch, and I recorded it when I landed and a little later in the studio. To me, it was just a little song, and I guess it's just a little song, you know, but it sounded good, and I still think it sounds good. I like singing it. You know, it's been 15 years. I don't get tired of it. So, you know, I have a few like this. Like I was saying, My Home Is Nowhere Without You. And again, it's like these songs that come from a little line that are true to your feelings at the time you write them. And I don't know. I just like this kind of songs, and I could sing them forever, which is good.
Thank you for listening. Join us again for episode 3. For more information about David Ivar and Herman Doone, including the finest range of merch for miles around, head over to hermandoone.net. Also, check out my website, frankburton.co.uk. See you soon!